how to handle this, but to take a little different approach tonight, because I want to look at chapter 27 and 28. If I read it all ahead of time, it's going to take a long time, because I want to go down through verse 19 of chapter 28 for tonight. So what I'm going to do is kind of outline things, and then we'll read it as we go along. In chapter 27, verses 1 through 3, we read these words. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of Man, take up a lament concerning Tyre. Say to Tyre, situated at the gateway to the sea, merchant of peoples on many coasts, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Now, you'll remember that we already had in chapter 26 two prophecies with regard to Tyre. We now come to a lamentation over the downfall of Tyre in chapter 27, and a further one which is spoken concerning the king of Tyre in chapter 28. Here in chapter 27, in this lamentation for Tyre, Tyre is pictured in a poetic image as a great ship on the high seas, which comes to a terrible shipwreck. Whenever I think of something like this, I think of the Titanic. I don't know if any of you have ever seen that magnificent black and white film, the British produced it, on the sinking of the Titanic. If you ever have a chance to see it, it's one of the greatest motion pictures I ever saw. And while it may not have been intended, it's really a wonderful message of how the careless and indifferent are overtaken by the judgment of God. It's really wonderful. We saw it at a youth camp once in New Zealand, had a profound impact because we related it to the judgment of God. Well, this is very appropriate because, as I showed you last week, off the coast of Palestine was this boat-shaped island of the Tyre that was so long resistant to overthrow. The one that was finally overthrown by Alexander the Great as he built that moat out to it. So this would be a very vivid and a telling picture of this event. Now, first of all, you'll notice the magnificence and beauty of this ship. You say, O Tyre, I am perfect in beauty. Your domain was on the high seas. Your builders brought your beauty to perfection. They made all your timbers of pine trees from cedar. They took a cedar from Lebanon to make a mast for you. Of oaks from Bashan they made your oars. Of cypress wood from the coasts of Cyprus they made your deck, inlaid with ivory. Fine embroidered linen from Egypt was your sail and served as your banner. Your awnings were of blue and purple from the coasts of Elisha. Men of Sidon and Arvad were your oarsmen. Your skilled men, O Tyre, were aboard as your seamen. Veteran craftsmen of Gebel were on board as shipwrights to caulk your seams. All the ships of the sea and their sailors came alongside to trade for your wares. Now you'll notice the various features here of a seagoing vessels. Timbers are mentioned, the mast, the oars, the deck, the sail, the awnings, the oarsmen, the caulk, and so on. And not only that, but each of these vital elements in the building of the ship comes from a different location, nation, or area. And the effect of that is to heighten the impression of the economic importance of this city. The far-flung economic dominance of Tyre is also suggested in the section that follows, beginning with verse 10 and running down through verse 24. Men of Persia, Lydia, and Put served as soldiers in your army. They hung their shields and helmets on your walls, bringing you splendor. Men of Arvad and Helek manned your walls on every side. Men of Gamad were in your towers. They hung their shields around your walls. They brought your beauty to perfection. Quite clearly, those verses show that the author is well aware that he's using a poetic symbolism, because he doesn't worry too much if he departs a bit from it, as he does in those verses. And then in verses 12 to 24, he mentions a whole list of places that did business with the great economic center in Tyre. And I want to relate some of these to you as I find them in this Jewish commentary, starting back there with verse 5, because they count too. The first place mentioned is Sinir, which was a mountainous district on the other side of the Jordan. Bashan also was a territory east of Jordan. The Isles of Kittim, the Kittites, in the Hebrew, is properly translated Cyprus in verse 6. And that refers to a well-known place to this day. Egypt is mentioned, the Isles of Elisha were probably Sicily near the toe of Italy. Sidon was a city north of Tyre and appears at this time to have been quite subordinate in its importance to Tyre. That wasn't always true, but at this time it was. Arvad is generally considered to have been the area north of Tripoli, now known as Ruad. Gebal was along the coast of Africa, midway between Tripoli and Beirut. Persia is the area now known as Iran. Lud and Put are Semitic terms, and while we are not certain, Lud is probably today's Lydia, and the area known as Put was at that time on the western coast of the Red Sea. It doesn't exist as an entity today. Helek is not known. Arvad has been mentioned. Gamadim is not known elsewhere, but ancient Jewish commentators understood it to be the area later known as Cappadocia, which is well known in Asia Minor during later church history. Tarshish, which you remember from the story of Jonah, was a district in southern Spain. Javan, Tubal, and Meshech are names mentioned in Genesis chapter 10, verse 2, in the early table of nations. Javan is the Hebrew term for the Eonians, who were Greek. Tubal and Meshech are usually identified with peoples who lived on the southeast and southern borders of the Black Sea. So you can see what a vast area of the ancient world we're touching upon here, and that's what I'm trying to get across. Togarma was probably later known as Armenia. Dedan was an Arabian tribal group living on the Persian Gulf. And Aram is later known as Syria. Minith was thought by the ancients to be a designation for the Ammonite area. Vedan is not certain, the identification of it. Javan was a Greek colony in Arabia, according to the ancient testimony of the rabbis. Arabia, well, everyone knows what that is. Kedar was a race in the Arabian desert also. Sheba and Reama are listed in the Table of Nations as descendants of Cush, and the Sheba probably becomes the Sabaean nation, a powerful Arabian people living in the southwest part of Arabia. And Reama was probably also a region on the Persian Gulf, very much in the news today in the place where all the oil of the world is going in and out. Haran was well known in the patriarchal period. Kena was probably a city in the Babylonian area, and Eden was thought to be situated on one or the other or both sides of the Euphrates, south of Haran. And Ashur was later known as Assyria. Well, if you were to mark out all those areas that are designated here, what you'd really have is a picture of virtually all of the then known world, and you would see a picture of the commerce of the then known world passing through in one way or another, going or coming, buying or selling, through the hands of this tiny island nation of Tyre that we are picturing here. So the importance of Tyre was economic, and its reach of importance was very vast. Then comes in verses 25 through 36 the account of the sinking, let's call it the Titanic. The sinking of the Titanic. The ships of Tarshish serve as carriers for your wares. You are filled with heavy cargo in the heart of the sea. Your oarsmen take you out to the high seas. But the east wind will break you to pieces in the heart of the sea. Your wealth, merchandise, and wares, your mariners, seamen, and shipwrights, your merchants and all your soldiers and everyone else on board. You can easily see this is going to be quite total and complete. Will sink into the heart of the sea on the day of your shipwreck. The shorelands will quake when your seamen cry out. That's obviously a picture of the distress that will strike those on land when this supposedly safe sea-surrounded city is overthrown. All who handle the oars will abandon their ships. The mariners and all the seamen will stand on the shore. They will raise their voice and cry bitterly over you. They will sprinkle dust on their heads and roll in ashes. They will shave their heads because of you and will put on sackcloth. They will weep over you with anguish of soul and with bitter mourning. As they wail and mourn over you, they will take up a lament concerning you. Who was ever silenced like Tyre, surrounded by the sea? When your merchants went out on the seas, you satisfied many nations. With your great wealth and your wares, you enriched the kings of the earth. Now you are shattered by the sea, in the depths of the waters. Your wares and all your company have gone down with you. All who live in the coastlands are appalled at you. Their kings shudder with horror, and their faces are distorted with fear. The merchants among the nations hiss at you. You have come to a horrible end and will be no more. Now, very little comment is needed because the picture is so vivid. But do notice verse 26. Your oarsmen take you out to the high seas, but the east wind will break you to pieces in the heart of the sea. And then again in verse 32, where it speaks of being surrounded by the sea, and then verse 34, shattered by the sea. Clearly, in this picture, we're not to think of a literal ocean or the Mediterranean Sea and the city sitting there surrounded by water as the primary thing. We are to think rather of their place among the nations. Because in the Bible, the vast sea of humanity is often, in poetic phraseology, called the sea. And it is by that sea, so long dominated economically by Tyre, by that very sea, she is now shattered, as it says in verse 34. Because, of course, it is the nations of the ancient world gathered together under the supremacy first of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, later Alexander the Great and the Macedonians, that comes and destroys this seaworthy vessel. So what you really have here in chapter 27, which I have gone over rather quickly, what I think you can see here for yourself is that in this oracle from the Lord, Ezekiel is simply presenting in a most vivid, pictorial way the coming downfall of Tyre, in such a way that it remains an unforgettable picture in the minds of the ancients. You've got to realize that they didn't have television, and so imagination and a prophetic symbolism of this kind would have a very powerful impact upon their minds, perhaps more, considerably more, than it does on ours. Now, you'll notice then in that section what it is that is going to happen. And then in chapter 28, we go on to consider this message heightened again to its utmost in the king of Tyre, in whom all of the glory of that dominion is concentrated. So you really have the two prophecies in chapter 26, a third in chapter 27, and now a fourth in chapter 28. And each one, in a certain sense, heightens the impact of what the prophet is saying about this kingdom. I say then that chapter 28 presents the same message again, heightened further, as Ezekiel now gives us a picture of Tyre concentrated in the prince or king as the one who embodies in himself the real character and glory and sin and shame of Tyre in its downfall. And this is shown, first of all, in the first part of the chapter in a prophecy. Now let's read that. It runs down through the first 10 verses. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, say to the ruler of Tyre, this is what the sovereign Lord says, in the pride of your heart, you say, I am a god. I sit on the throne of a god in the heart of the seas. Just a side comment there. That could be translated, as the older translations put it, I sit on the throne of God in the heart of the sea. And no, in the pride of your heart, you say, I am God. I sit on the throne of God in the heart of the seas. Because the Hebrew word there is the word for God. So it's a translator's choice to put it the way it is in the NIV, and I rather regret the way they've put it. Anybody have the King James in front of you? Nobody does. Well, I think it's put there, God. Somebody have one at the handy, they might look it up for us. Are you wiser than Daniel? Is no secret hidden from you? By your wisdom and understanding you have gained wealth for yourself and amassed gold and silver in your treasuries. By your great skill in trading you have increased your wealth, and because of your wealth your heart has grown proud. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says, because you think you are wise as God, I believe it should be, I am going to bring foreigners against you, the most ruthless of nations. They will draw their swords against your beauty and wisdom and pierce your shining splendor. They will bring you down to the pit. You will die a violent death in the heart of the seas. Will you then say, I am God, in the presence of those who kill you? You will be but a man, not God, in the hands of those who slay you. You will die the death of the uncircumcised at the hands of foreigners. I have spoken, declares the sovereign Lord. Now you'll notice that the sin of the prince or king of Tyre is the sin of pride, wherein he is so convinced of his own wisdom and attainments through that wisdom that he has come to feel himself to be virtually divine. That's the idea of it. A god to us conveys the idea of something very much semi-god, but the idea here is the man thinks of himself as divine. And that, of course, is the ultimate blasphemy that Satan originally planted as the first temptation for man. You will be as God. You'll be divine, in other words. Well, this is the temptation to which the prince of Tyre has succumbed because of the tremendous attainments. And you see that in the first five verses. And then in verses 6 to 10, the certainty that God, who really is God, the sovereign Jehovah, the one and living true God, in verse 6 there, will bring this proud ruler to utter destruction. And one can almost say, what comment is needed? Except the one that is made in verse 9. Will you then say, I am divine? When this happens to you, well, of course, the obvious answer to that rhetorical question is no, of course I won't. How could anyone? And then in verses 11 to 19 comes the final oracle on this matter. So if you divide chapter 28 into two parts, you really end up with five complete oracles. But in any case, it still deals with the king of Tyre. So let us read from verse 11 to 19. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, take up a lament concerning the king of Tyre and say to him, this is what the sovereign Lord says, you were the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you. ruby, topaz, and emerald, chrysolite, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and beryl. Your settings and mountings were made of gold. On the day you were created, they were prepared. You were anointed as a guardian cherub, for so I ordained you. You were on the holy mount of God. You walked among the fiery stones. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created till wickedness was found in you. Through your widespread trade, you were filled with violence and you sinned. So I drove you in disgrace from the mount of God, and I expelled you, O guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones. Your heart became proud on account of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. So I threw you to the earth. I made a spectacle of you before kings. By your many sins and dishonest trade, you have desecrated your sanctuaries. So I made a fire come out from you, and it consumed you. And I reduced you to ashes on the ground in the sight of all who were watching. All the nations who knew you are appalled at you. You have come to a horrible end and will be no more. Now that's generally regarded as to be one of the most difficult passages in the Old Testament. And the interpretations of it have varied considerably. There are quite a number of expositors of Ezekiel, especially those of the dispensational variety, who believe that this really isn't talking about the king of Tyre at all, but Satan. And if you want to read it that way, you can say, well, it makes quite a bit of sense. And others take it to be a reference, not really to the king of Tyre, but to something that he, in a faint, suggestive sort of way, prefigured, namely the great Antichrist of the future. Well, I just want you to know that I completely reject both of these views. That isn't to say that nothing satanic is here, because Satan is always involved in evil. Always. But I see here another symbolic representation, not so different from the one we saw in chapter 27. Never was Tyre really a ship out in the sea like the mighty Titanic, but it can be poetically pictured that way with great effect. And the same can be said here, and I think you will have to agree that what the prophet is doing here is setting forth the glory of the king of Tyre under the likeness of Adam in a creation setting. You'll notice the perfection, the wisdom, the beauty, the Garden of Eden, and the anointing, and the garden of the guardian cherub. And I regard that reference to the cherub as the real key to understanding the whole thing. Now, here is the simple historical fact. When the city-state kingdom of Tyre was founded, it was beautiful in the sight of God Himself. Now, that may sound far-fetched, but don't forget that in our earlier study, we noted that the testimony of the ancients is that Tyre was a very, very ancient city, possibly going back to 2700 B.C. Others saying about 1700 B.C., but in any event, that takes it way, way back from the time of this prophet to very early history. And we know from the fact that Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek that in the ancient world there were, for a long time after the flood and the beginning of the spread of the human race over the world, there were isolated pockets of godly people, such as in the city of Salem where Melchizedek was a priest king. His superiority to Abraham is evident in the fact that the lesser paid tithes to the greater, and that's commented on in the book of Hebrews. It would be completely against all analogy, then, to imagine that Melchizedek was the only other man in the world at that time who retained a godly tradition. I believe, then, that there's every reason to think that at the time that Tyre was founded, this could have been its character and quality. And probably its extreme longevity as a people, as a political entity in the ancient world, was due to many of the good things that continued in its historical tradition from that early time. So that it could well be poetically compared to Adam in the Garden of Eden, blessed in every way, and then later departing from God and sinning against Him and losing that state of favor with God and being brought to a horrible end. And then in the middle of it, you see this use of the idea of the anointed cherub. Now, this is all the more remarkable when you realize that in the early chapters of this book, it was the cherubim vision that first motivated the prophet when he saw this chariot vehicle with the amazing manifestation of life, and in the midst of it, something that was like unto the Son of Man, and so on. Now, I said in the beginning, when I tried to expound that, that I see the cherubim not as a real existing creature, but rather as a symbolic, prophetic representation of the whole of creation. And that's why it's composite, having the face of the ox and the face of the lion and the eagle and so on. In other words, bringing in various symbols from the various kingdoms of the living creatures of the earth into union with this godlike and yet manlike being. What it really shows is it's a prophetic, symbolic representation of man as he was created by God to be, namely, the ruling head over the whole creation. We tend to think of man in isolation from nature, but that is not the way God created him. God created man to have dominion over the creatures and to have unity with them in a kingdom that was in the joyful service of the living God. Well, that was true in paradise, and then when Adam sinned, he was driven out, but he still saw the vision of that at the gates of paradise. And then here in this representation, you have a great king ruling over a society that is blessed beyond any other in the ancient world, and everything in unity under that sovereign makes him like an anointed cherub. Let me say that I cannot see any possible way that designation in verse 14a could ever be applied to Satan. Because if our understanding of the meaning of the cherubim is correct, it could not be applied to Satan. Because the angels do not have that relationship to the natural order that man does. The angels are spirits. They do not have a unity with the creation of God as man does. Man, like the beasts, is made of the dust of the earth. Man is made to have dominion over them. That's not true of the angels. So you can't say that Satan at any time would have been an anointed guardian cherub of the creation that was manifest in Eden. As a matter of fact, he was already a fallen angel when God put Adam in Eden, as you well know, because he came there as the serpent. But if you think of Adam as he was, and then man as he is restored in Christ, you see how the cherubim idea ties together, and you can also see how that could be used in this poetic representation, just as things like Eden could be brought into it as a symbolic representation of the glory and beauty of the original civilization and society founded in Tyre. Think then of a city-state founded by godly people, people of the caliber and character of Melchizedek in Abraham's time. Think of an early civilization that was highly cultured and greatly blessed of God, a truly godly society, but which by the time of Ezekiel had utterly fallen. And it seems to me then that you have exactly what is required to fit this picture. If we view it this way, we can also understand even more clearly the earlier cherubim visions. For those earlier cherubim visions are really visions of Christ as the exalted God-man in headship over the whole of God's natural creation. Because that natural creation is to be restored. Don't forget, the whole creation groans together in travail until now, waiting for the redemption of the sons of God. That can only mean that the lower creatures also somehow share ultimately in that restoration. And that's exactly what the cherubim symbolism is all about. So Adam, the king of Tyre, and Christ and the final kingdom of God all have those characteristics in common. I believe also that we can say something quite significant about another part of the Bible. If you'll turn very quickly to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul the Apostle is writing to settle the minds of the unsettled Thessalonians. And he says, "Don't let anyone deceive you," verse 3, "for that day," and that day is the day of the Lord, which some had said had already come, that day will not come, he says, until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. And then it says, he will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. It is commonly thought by careless students of the Bible that this must be, quote, the great Antichrist, unquote, because nothing else in the Bible equals the audacity of that provocative claim. Well, that's not true. That's just not true. The Prince of Tyre, in the imagery of prophetic language, did exactly the same thing. Now look at chapter 28, verse 2. In the pride of your heart you say, I am God. It's exactly the same text in Greek, the Septuagint. I sit on the throne of God in the heart of the sea. But you're a man and not a God. Now, if you want to believe that the Antichrist concept is correct, then at least you're going to have to change your Antichrist concept from the popular one. The popular one is that when the Antichrist comes, he's going to be the greatest world dictator the world has ever seen. He's going to run everything. Well, the King of Tyre didn't run everything. He was important in terms of commerce and trade, but he didn't run everything. He was nothing in comparison with Nebuchadnezzar. See? As is just demonstrated by the fact that he was overthrown by him. So, by analogy, if the writer of the Apostle Paul is using Old Testament symbolism with accuracy, he would have missed the boat if he is trying to picture for us someone that is obviously the coming world dictator. I don't think there's any basis at all for that. If you study 1 John, you find that John says the Antichrist is not future, but present. He says that most clearly. Not one, but many, and not a man at all, but a spirit. Because he says, many have gone out into the world who deny that Jesus is the Christ. This is that Antichrist whereof you have heard that it's come, and is already in the world. So the idea of a future Superman type of Hitler raised to the nth power off in the future has no biblical basis, and we should be entirely free from the hypnotic influence of any such view. The Antichrist is a manifold phenomenon, and you see it there in the Prince of Tyre. You want to call that Antichrist? That's all right with me. Probably is Antichrist. He's calling himself God instead of calling the true God God. But there are many of such in every historical era. You see this phenomenon, and the one in 2 Thessalonians 2, I believe, is undoubtedly the Roman ruler who came to stand in the temple. So let us make sure that we learn to understand these Old Testament prophetic images, symbols, and descriptions. Are they exaggerated? Yes, if you think you have to always be literal. But they're not exaggerated in terms of poetic imagery. That's the point. Of course, the Prince of Tyre was never, in literal fact, a cherubim, a cherub, an anointed cherub. But he was like that. That's the idea in that prophetic picture. Here, then, is the great danger signal for any nation. Pride in its own greatness brings judgment. I'll never forget when I was in New Zealand, we were listening one time to, I think it was Lyndon Baines Johnson, boasting about the invincibility of America. in Vietnam, and how we would never weary and never waver and so on. And I remember one of my elders, he's gone now to be with the Lord, but one of the elders said it just made him shudder. He thought immediately of the day that Nebuchadnezzar was walking on the roof of his palace boasting about how great he was. Because he said, I felt right there and then that Almighty God wasn't going to stand for that. Well, he didn't either. And it seems that every president we've had in recent time falls victim to this. They get the feeling that they are almost godlike. And they can't admit when they make a real big blunder. Now, our president has made a big blunder in Iran, and he won't admit it. And that is tragic. And it's the same disease. And we have to really be sorry about that. We have to pray that this can be overcome. Pride in their own greatness is what brings the judgment and the disaster. We need to learn the type of symbolism used by the prophets also to understand the New Testament apostles. Finally, you learn from this passage that the biblical criterion of what is important is not at all the same as the world's. Why was Tyre so important that it rates all the space, three chapters, in Ezekiel? Because of their high and noble beginning, their tragic fall under the curse of pride, and the disaster which overtook them. It's a spiritual matter. It's the magnitude of the spiritual contrast that rates such a place in the Bible. Otherwise, Tyre isn't important. It's just a city. Be like Singapore. What's Singapore in the world today? Well, it's kind of like Tyre. Boy, you go to Singapore, you can't believe it. That little island city nation. The business and commerce of the world goes through that place. But that's the way God dealt with them because of their pride. And my point is that the criterion of God for what's important is not the same as that of man. Well, we'll have to leave it there.